This is No More Normal, and thank you for joining us. I'm Khalil Colonna. If you have listened to the show for a while, a few months back, you may have heard an interview we had with Stephen Hines, a co-chair of the Commission on the Practice of Democratic Citizenship. The commission is charged with discovering ways to activate participation of United States citizens in democratic civil life. So that's what they did. After spending 2 years and hundreds of hours talking with people all around the country about what's working and what's not, a group of 35 scholars, business leaders, and civic catalysts from all over the political and social spectrum have created a document. It's called Our Common Purpose, and it was put out by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. These are practical, real solutions to freshen up our system of government, to update it so the people, all of us, are back in the driver's seat. The Nomono team read it, and we were inspired to gather a panel of citizens to debate these ideas. We'll hear from Darshan Gu, one of the authors of the report, Dr. Gerald Chavez, a clinical psychologist, Gus Pedrotti, a mayoral candidate in 2017, business owner Christelle Ziarza, Pastor Barry Bitzer, Oriana Sandoval from the Center for Civic Policy, and college student and poli-sci major Taylor Velasquez. Today's episode is dedicated to that conversation. We did it through Zoom. Yes, my favorite. It's a fascinating discussion. Let's get to it. Part one, representation. We'll explore how each citizen is represented, what changes could be made to increase the actuality and feeling that each of us is represented. Check it out.
One of the biggest challenges to having a representative government is representation itself. One of the first recommendations here is to expand the number of people in the House of Representatives so that each representative represents fewer people. They suggest starting with about 50 more members to the House. We thought it would be great to have an author of the project on the show, and we're lucky that Darshan Gu is joining us. Darshan is the Program Director for American Institutions, Society, and the Public Good. So Darshan, let me ask you, how would this addition of more members to the House affect the Electoral College map and create even representation across the country, particularly for national elections, presidential elections?
Sure. So I'll just say that 50 is not necessarily the perfect number, but it's a number that the commission agreed to. The idea, you know, is the House of Representatives, when it was originally envisioned by our founders, is the people's house. And they originally had a goal of, you know, that there would be one representative for every 30,000 constituents. Now we are at 1 to 750,000. It hasn't grown since 1912, even as the United States population has increased substantially. The goal with this recommendation really is to start to move the House of Representatives back to the original vision of the founders by increasing the number of representatives in the House. It becomes to reflect more of the people that the representatives are elected to represent. And of course, as part of that, because the Electoral College is, you know, partly determined in size by the number of members of the House of Representatives, it would change the Electoral College math as well.
We'll start with Barry Bitzer. Barry, you're the executive pastor for Legacy Church, and you've also served as the communications director for former U.S. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson and press secretary for Congressman Steve Schiff. As someone who has worked in the Capitol building and been involved with politics, how does the idea of expanding the House land with you?
I worked on the Hill, on the House side and the Senate side, and terrifies me to think there'd be even more of those guys and gals running around than we already have. But I get the whole idea that a congressional district has gotten very large compared to what the founders envisioned. I think the same way about our school district. We got one of the biggest school districts in the country here in Albuquerque, and the top 50 are all behemoths that are basically unaccountable to those they're supposed to serve. I'm open to it. I'm curious as to where Gus lands on this one, too.
Gus Pedrotti, one-time mayoral candidate, now the coordinator of the Office of Applied Complexity at the Santa Fe Institute. How does this strike you?
On the surface, I think it's a fine idea. It definitely brings up issues of the functionality of the body. I was surprised the document didn't have, alongside that recommendation, prescriptions for the Senate side about, you know, what are we asking the House to achieve by having more representation if so many of the other controlling dynamics at the federal level still exist? You know, because then that makes me wonder, why am I electing someone? Like, what is their function in my life? And this is a huge conversation of what is the federal government to any of us? How do we define state versus local governments? I always wanted to bring that down to saying, you know, if I'm looking at this as a legislative body, and if I believe increased or more intimate representation matters, can I ask that question about our city council? In Albuquerque, right, we're a city of around 550,000 people. We're an interesting city because we're a tiny metro area, but a massive city. We are a big city. We have 9 councilors. And then we also, when we compare that, right, Baltimore, 600,000 people, large metro area, 15 councilors with an at-large councilor. So I am in for increased representation and also increased understanding of what each representative of me does for my living in a public space.
Oriana is the CEO for the Center of Civic Policy and the co-director of the New Mexico Civic Engagement Table. You've worked on economic security, environmental justice, and civil rights issues for more than a decade. Give us your thoughts here.
I think a lot of focus should also be on the Senate. I forget the exact stats off the top of my head, but I think within 10 years, maybe like 20% of the population in the country will have the same amount of representation in the Senate as the rest of us. So it's undemocratic to have 2 senators from each state, given how the population trends are happening in this country. And I would also add another policy reform on top of more representation in Congress, both the House and the Senate. I would propose that we need to abolish or bypass the Electoral College. It is a vestige that is deeply, deeply undemocratic and subverts the will of the voters. So I think that has to be a priority. There is a movement. I believe it's called the National Popular Vote Compact.
Darshan, was there a specific reason why the Senate wasn't really addressed with these recommendations?
Sure. And the Electoral College. So our commission comprised a diverse group of thought leaders, scholars, practitioners, former elected officials, folks from a range of backgrounds and ideologies. And one of the things that this group really wanted to think about as it put forward this report, because it was a bipartisan group, was to find recommendations that they could reach bipartisan consensus around. And so the final set of 31 recommendations represent a lot of compromise, a lot of long, hard discussions. And I can tell you all of the ideas you all have surfaced here today that you don't see in the report were talked about and really interrogated by the group. And at the end of the day, the commission wanted to put forth a set of recommendations that they could agree to. All of our commissioners signed on with unanimous agreement to this full body of recommendations. We thought it was important to show that it was possible for a bipartisan group to find a set, to agree, to compromise, to put forward a set of recommendations together that really could make a significant change in how our democracy functions, and that it is possible even today for that to happen. And also to put forward a set of recommendations that they thought were achievable. Recommendations around Senate reform and the Electoral College did not make the cut.
Dr. Gerald Chavez, you're a clinical psychologist who's been practicing for over 24 years. We hit you up because you understand how we connect to each other as people. Let me ask you, like, the whole thing about the House of Representatives and elected officials is that we have to relate to them. We have to be able to talk to them, and that communication is dropped. Should something like this happen, we get 50 or 75 or 100 more members of the House. What do you think that does as far as like the citizen and the voters' connection to those people they voted for?
Well, take a step back. When we look at, from a psychological standpoint, as a person who worked with people across the board, and the uneasiness of what's going on, I think, and the lack of trust, and I think in your document you talk about truth and trust. If we want to go back down to a better understanding, if we increase it by 50, great. But does 50 then increase the confusion? Does 50 add clarity to what's happening? So I think we need to front load it with some clarity first. You know, when we look at these crazy gerrymandering maps, and we look at all this stuff, and the person who's just working their 9 to 5 and then their evening job, they look at this stuff, and it's kind of like, well, they're uneasy, and there's an uneasiness in the country, obviously. So I think with increasing it, by all means, it needs to happen. Better representation is one, but how do we increase the trust of these people? And I think that's probably some real grassroots stuff that needs to happen. I mean, something to where they can really get to know these people, and the feedback that they're given should be taken into consideration, obviously, and not just listened to and then tossed aside and going into whatever their agenda was in the first place.
Okay. The idea of passing federal legislation that makes voting a requirement, kind of like jury duty, is a very, very interesting one. As a matter of fact, I did an Instagram poll last night and asked people, would they go? And initially, it was mostly no. It was mostly no, they wouldn't do it. I clarified it a little bit and said, if you had an option to vote none of the above, and suddenly it was 75% yes. Taylor Velasquez, you're studying political science and American studies at UNM. Let me ask you, how would you think of that idea? Voting is a requirement the same as jury duty.
Yeah, right. So I do think it's a good idea to have that requirement. I do see the extra benefit of adding voting for none of the above. But if you think about it, these people who are running are really going to impact your life, especially in local elections. They're going to directly impact you. And you should want to go out and at least experience that of voting for someone. So I do think there is multiple benefits of maybe, oh, I'm not, this time I am going to vote for none of the above, but going through that process, maybe it's something that I want to look into for the next election and be more involved in civic life.
I think it's a possible way to prevent voter suppression. If it's mandatory that you vote in elections, even if it's none of the above. Crystal, you own a social media and web marketing company, Ciarza Social Digital. Do you think like having a measure like that would change the kinds of candidates that could win? And would it change how candidates campaign to people if everyone were required to cast a vote?
You know, I looked at what Australia does because that did come into conversation, and I understand that they do have mandatory voting. They do receive a fine if they don't actually participate. It is something that has really created a sense of unity in the country. But we do run the risk of the elections then becoming a popularity contest, and that if it does become a popularity contest, that if you are going to do mandatory voting, then the election reform for campaign financing needs to be added almost at the same time, if not before, because then campaign managers will then become marketers. It's not a matter of marketing policy at that point in time. It becomes a matter of marketing for popularity. Who can be the person that has the most well-known voice that no matter what their policies and platforms might be, for those that might not be civically engaged as, say, the forum that we're currently in front of, it presents an opportunity for people just to simply say, we should vote for this person because they look pretty, because they've won a Super Bowl, or something along the lines where they've had a larger national stage outside of the political arena.
What do you think, Gus?
Yeah, I was about to say, I think there are no bumpers for that already. I mean, we've already seen celebrities achieve almost every office in the country, like historically Reagan. I mean, this is a very interesting document to try and piece apart here and contextualize in different ways, because there are so many things, and the order of which getting through these things matters. So like if you were to enact a universal voting measure tomorrow, all of a sudden this would have horrible inequities attached to it. You would be hitting people with fines because they don't have access to a ballot box because voter suppression is real. We had like a conniption fit trying to figure out how to mail ballots as a country because there's so many problems in our election process. And so I think, you know, how you reform elections overall is a big deal. But you have to focus on access and equity first before you can even start about penalizing groups of people.
But Gus, my argument is, along with addressing the points that you're talking about, campaign finance reform also needs to happen at the same time. Because yes, I can understand that you guys use the arguments previously. It's a completely different demographic and a completely different time, especially with the generations that are of different races and different demographics compared to what it was during the Reagan era.
I still believe that American politics is by and large a popularity contest. And I think that's also apparent in the media and how it hasn't changed. I mean, you could look at Dukakis' ads versus ads today, and they're still mostly like trailers, like personality pitches.
Yeah, but guess your election for the mayoral race proved that wrong, your exact point wrong, that you still got 9% of the vote by not being the popular candidate. That's the easy way to debate against your exact point.
Except I didn't win.
True.
This time. Go ahead, Barry.
I want to take Christelle's approach and be a devil's advocate here for a moment and say there seems to be this universal consensus that getting the least interested, least engaged person to show up at the ballot box is somehow a good thing. It scares me to think that the swing vote, if you will, out there is being driven to the polls in the least uninformed, least steeped in the consequences and the process. And like y'all were saying, most prone to a popularity contest. I also want to back up for a second and say that when we talk about pure democracy, the founding fathers worked hard against that because in its worst form, pure democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for dinner. So there have to be checks and balances against the tyranny of the majority, if you will. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that in too.
I see your points, and we're going to have to end this subject. But personally, I look at it, you know, I was debating this with my housemates last night as I was preparing for today, and they were asking about, well, why wasn't this in the Constitution in the first place? And I'm like, well, if we look at people who founded the country and the democracy, they didn't want everybody to vote. They didn't want everybody to vote. They particularly didn't want women to vote. They didn't want people of African descent to vote and others for very obvious reasons. When you think about it, we don't have many qualifications to be citizens. It's that, you know, you're born here or you become naturalized. If you're a male, you apply for selective service at 18 and you're supposed to, I highlight supposed to pay your taxes. And that's about it.
Part two, connection. We're talking about how citizens and their elected representatives communicate and interact. It's a growing world, and the process is more important than ever.
According to the document, as we all know, citizens don't feel that they're represented in part because of lack of access and connection. Dr. Chavez, we talked several times for No More Normal about, you know, the interpersonal relationships that people were suffering through during COVID. And it feels like, you know, it was a huge break last year. Are you going to wear a mask or you're not going to wear a mask, and how that's folded into the division and divisiveness within people. And then that spilled over to politics, depending on who you voted for. What are some ways that we can, one, understand, connect with each other so we can have trust, particularly trust within our governmental institutions?
Think of this as a baseline. This isn't the only baseline, but it is a baseline that I tend to use. And that is, when we have an emotion, that emotion was derived from thought. And if the thought is distorted, the emotion is going to be a little strange or a little weird. Are you going to believe? I just recently got both of my shots. I've had a couple people sort of accost me over the fact that I got these shots. And I didn't quite know what to say to them. That's their choice not to take the shot. And I decided to take the shot. And they, you know, they talked about they implanted something in me. Now I'm being tracked. I just know that happens with my cell phone already. And so it's kind of like, and so what's very important to understand, when you start to emote over something like gerrymandering or, you know, how long a Supreme Court justice is in place. But the reality is, so when you start to emote, look for the thoughts that are creating that emotion. Are they distorted? Are they, remember, when you talk about belief, belief is stuck in between your cognitive self and your emotional self. So once you lock in a belief, man, that is really hard. That's when the Kool-Aid starts flowing. Okay. So it's really important to, for our own self-evaluation, to look at, we start to feel something, go back in and evaluate, be self-critical, really try to figure out why you're feeling that. Do not use that feeling to act, because thought, emotion, behavior. Once you're in behavior stage and the emotion is guiding you, all bets are off. People often fall in love with the wrong person, buy a car they can afford or they don't like, or say something they didn't mean. That's the action. And as I told you in our first No More Normal, where I talk about using a checkup from the neck up, that's extremely important right now. Whenever anything is going on and you're feeling it, why did you, I mean, you tell your kids that, think before you act. Don't just cross the street, stop and look, listen, try to figure that out. And this document is a beautiful baseline and a beautiful starting point for that. It got me to think, and I listen to the news all the time and I try to be a really good consumer of that, but this really opens some doors. So it helped me evaluate, and I felt less emotional about certain things. When we talk about gerrymandering, I feel like I have a little better grasp of it now, and I don't get upset about it, so to speak. So that's my
take. Thank you. Gus, let me ask you, what are some ways you would like to see contact and communication increase between lawmakers and voters and their constituents?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because I feel like we're living through part of that experiment today, right? COVID-19 has changed, has forced groups to change. And in a lot of ways, it's more accessible and should open more doors. But at the same time, there's these removals. I would have never told anyone that if they wanted to get involved in community or make an impact to show up to a city council meeting. Like, that's not a recommendation I would ever tell somebody. You stand there, you listen to beautiful arguments, and you watch a board of people that you're like, this decision's already been made. And I've heard all these great arguments. There are quotes of this in the Academy's document as well. You know, the thing I want representatives to do when they think about structurally, how do they better serve their communities, is I want them to secede power. Like, I want them to do the things we talk about in this document, like implementing participatory budgeting. You know, if they want the community to engage more, if they want to understand the community's will and be a better steward of the community towards this shared infrastructure we have that is government, I want them to walk the walk. Instead of disempowering neighborhood associations across generations, I would like them to incentivize organizing and say, if you are coming together as a group of people of which you are represented by geographically, then you should have the ability to say, how are we spending these dollars for a park, right? You should be able to say, like, here's the data. Like, the city should be able to give us the data for us to figure out the best bus stop for our community. And I want to be involved in a very tangible and real way. And I want more representatives to push for governing in that manner. Participatory budgeting isn't new. It's gaining huge steam in EU. Poland's trying it in like four different ways, in rural and in urban settings. You know, it's happening in New York now. That's just like one way where you could start cracking open the bin of how do community members actually engage in governmental processes and see the immediate impact. You could even go, and I know, Barry, like, I can't wait to hear what you're going to say on this, but I think you could even go one step forward and say neighborhood associations could be bastions for economic development in their own communities by saying neighborhood associations can run actual cooperatives. And instead of government giving individual business loans, you can incentivize community organizing in an already existing structure of business. And that would help, especially in Albuquerque, solve some of these empty storefronts and give neighborhood associations ownership in discussions like, what is a living wage in my community? Or how do I show up for these values that I believe in? And so those are just some ways that it's not just, I want another Facebook Live. It's not saying, let's get on Zoom so I can do this for my home. It's saying, let me drive. Like, let us as a community steer the wheel together.
Barry Bitzer.
I would argue in a different direction in terms of showing up at a city council meeting or a county commission meeting. I worked at City Hall for Marty Chavez for 5 years, and 99.9% of the public never shows up for anything. The world belongs to those who do show up. I think I demonstrated that when I was working at the Biopark Society and wanted to make off with a couple of million dollars of bond money to build an otter exhibit at the aquarium. And they told me, oh, you got to get in line. It's a 10-year wait. And I was like, I got 80,000 Biopark Society members. I can get one half of 1% of them to weigh in with their county commissioner. First, I got to teach them who their county commissioner is, because most people in the city have no idea. But if I can get one half of 1% of them to just use the word otters, I will get my $2 million bond amendment. And I did. I probably only got 0.25% of the folks that we had in our membership list to show up or to call it right. And it was a political tsunami for them. The one commissioner I couldn't get to vote for it, nonetheless, said enough, you know, too many phone calls, too many emails. Showing up does make it have a big difference, especially in a small state. You have extraordinary access to your U.S. senators. A big state like California has got no more senators than we do. We have disproportionate amount of influence as folks from a small community or a small state. But people are busy, and they're not well enough informed and not well enough motivated to do that. Really, ultimately, if you want to get to the root cause of what I think you're trying to do with this document, you need a better educated electorate. You need to start, you know, pre-K through 16, as opposed to hoping folks make it through the ninth grade. Once you have that better educated electorate, you'll have a more active and engaged electorate as well.
Crystal.
So I think we can use the New Mexico State Legislature as a perfect example for this argument that I'm about to bring up, which is broadband. We can use what's happening currently at the New Mexico Legislature as an example for broadband, because there is a major challenge of access in many different ways. Obviously, the New Mexico Legislature doesn't understand how to keep transparency laws in mind with the challenges of technology. And we don't know if whether or not that's the legislature's fault or if it's the people that actually run the legislature from the actual infrastructure of the legislature, not the actual legislators themselves, right? And if the public is having challenges of accessing the legislators at the moment because they can't get a damn link to a Zoom call, who's to say that our federal government would have this challenge? But it's not just the connectivity from the actual source of the information itself or from those that actually make the laws. But Viante New Mexico put out a really fascinating report of why they're focusing on broadband bills. And it's because broadband is only implemented in only about 55% of our state. And so that means that if we're trying to create an opportunity for people to connect with their legislator, obviously the internet is theoretically speaking that connector between us and Albuquerque to Washington, D.C. But if a place like Farmington has limited broadband access, or myself that doesn't have a lot of broadband in the Rio Rancho area, how can we truly connect with the use of technology to reach our elected officials? That's something that has been missed in these conversations, especially in the age of the pandemic. And I think that's worthy of considering in any of the studies, especially on this one, that what is the impact of broadband and the lack of connectivity in rural areas to actually create a community of civic engagement?
Oriana, what are your thoughts here?
Just to keep going on what Crystal was saying, I would agree. You know, I think the pandemic has been very challenging. We just came off of census work, and it was extremely challenging to not be able to do face-to-face on the ground organizing with hard-to-count communities. But it forced us to look at technology, both the pros and the cons, right? And how to use that to keep engaging folks. And I think we see that during the legislative session too, that there's opportunities where non-pandemic, the roundhouse is really not that accessible to New Mexicans anyway, right? You have to travel hours to go, wait hours to go into the committee hearing. So I think this gives us the opportunity to really think through what are the technology opportunities to make this normalized, even when the roundhouse is open again or other chambers of government. You know, something that my organization with a lot of other advocacy groups have been working on is working with Legislative Council Service around language access issues. We actually were able to get some money in the feed bill, I believe it passed, but just to provide a pot of money for interpretation services for folks that, you know, have to signing or Spanish or other languages, so they're able to effectively participate and understand what's happening via the online session. So I think, you know, in times of challenges, it forces us to think through and be innovative and think through different ways of engagement.
This is Nomona, aka No More Normal. I'm Kaliole Colonna. You have been listening to a panel discussion on the document Our Common Purpose, put out by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. It is a document that proposes modern changes to the Constitution to better fit modern American society. There's a lot more to discuss. Stay with us as we dive in. No More Normal is brought to you by Your New Mexico Government, a collaboration between KUNM, New Mexico PBS, and the Santa Fe Reporter. Funding for our coverage comes from the New Mexico Local News Fund, the Kellogg Foundation, and KUNM listeners like you. Support for public media provided by the Thornburg Foundation. Hear us each week on KUNM Sundays at 11 a.m. Find past episodes online at KUNM.org or wherever you look for podcasts.
Talk about the Supreme Court. You know, right now, Supreme Court justice is appointed by the president, then confirmed by Congress. They're there for life. Trump was able to appoint 3 of the 9, fully 1/3 of the bench right now. But Our Common Purpose is proposing 18-year term limits for Supreme Court justices, and their terms would be staggered so they wouldn't all come up at once. The idea feels radical, but it's pretty straightforward. What potential drawbacks do you see from this at all? Crystal Ciarza.
I don't have a drawback.
You don't have a drawback? How do you feel about it?
This was a topic that I was researching in high school back in 2005. And it was a subject because at the time during the George W. Bush administration, they were nervous that he would have the control of 2, potentially 3 Supreme Court justices. And obviously Trump, you know, 15, 16 years later, created that opportunity. If you do the math, approximately 2.5 presidents would go through the cycle of 18 years, or if, depending on how often the election, the terms actually do exist for a president where, you know, let's say, for example, there is a new president every 4 years, up to 5 presidents have an opportunity to change the Supreme Court justices. It does present a really strong argument. I know that the days of RBG are, you know, rest in peace, but for those that are not only big fans and supporters and believe in what, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg did as a Supreme Court justice, I think that it will give us more opportunity to have individuals like her on the Supreme Court. That way we can preserve those historical judgments that have been placed upon our society. This is a matter of equal distribution among the presidential opportunities. Senate's changed in 18 years. Senators are sometimes in office for over, you know, like Biden was in office for almost 45, 50 years before, you know, becoming vice president. You know, the Senate would have, you know, having their confirmation vote would be really critical. And the timing is the most appealing process. And the natural progression of our democracy would work in favor of an 18-year term. Big time.
We'll take this to Barry. What do you think?
I would tend to concur. Another problem with our current system is that we're tending to nominate them younger and less experienced in order to have that lifetime tenure longevity actuarially outlast what would normally be a tenured in the old days before we got so prone to using the court as another way of legislating from the bench. You appointed older, more experienced folks to the court. We started to get away from that in more recent generations to stack the court for the long haul. That gives you less experienced jurists over folks who are probably much more eminently qualified, but might not last as long.
And if you're thinking about like the major issues like abortion change, LGBTQ, you know, it took longer for changes like that to happen because of the highest court, you know, making those decisions. It took years of repeals. And I think that it would actually modernize our society quicker and eliminate a lot of that sentiment of going back into time or accidentally reversing values or changes that have happened. Things would get done and reversed quickly.
Taylor Velasquez, you're studying political science and American studies at UNM. How do you feel about the future when you look at ideas like this being posited as potentially being a way that our government is run?
Yeah, I mean, as a political science major, I feel like this is every political science major's dream to read this kind of document because it's addressing those bridges where we're like, well, we're reading the Constitution, we're reading the Declaration of Independence, but we're also reading modern Supreme Court cases. Right. And they kind of seem like they're in contradiction with each other most times. So we're asking, well, why can we predict what justice is going to go this way and what justice is going to go that way? And we're told, well, the court is political. It's in the political system. And we're told to kind of accept it and move on. But I feel like this document kind of flips the script and puts it back into the people's hands and goes back into this idea of where the employers as the people and our officials, our justices, our employees. And we have that right to roll back at any time and say, well, no, we don't like what's going on. And we can take these ideas and recommendations that are in this document and say, well, yeah, this is going to match up to our modern day and modern life.
Part 3, application. We're getting into how citizens and lawmakers are using technology and innovation to apply the functions of government, hence Zoom. Yay!
Social media, as we know, has changed the way we live, communicate, and understand our world. Our common purpose calls for social media to become more active in dismantling disinformation. Crystal, you own a social media and web marketing company, Ciarza Social Digital. What do you think of this recommendation? Should private companies be more into monitoring not only just misinformation and disinformation, but should they be incumbent to become involved a little bit more as far as just giving out civic information to voters around policy issues and things?
I think that's actually what helps create what many feel, and I feel, a successful election. You know, putting on Instagram and Facebook as an example of where to find your voting polls, how many people actually voted in early voting, identifying who your politician is. I think that's something that many of us in business call corporate social responsibility. You know, I definitely don't speak for Mark Zuckerberg and I definitely don't speak for Jack at Twitter, but I think that there is a major responsibility as a business to show what damage or what strength can you add to a community. I think it was a very responsible move for them to encourage civic engagement. And remember, it doesn't always have to be social media companies or even television media companies or news organizations that actually can create a campaign for civic duty or encouraging for civic engagement. For the first time ever, the NFL did it too. Seeing Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll telling people to vote was one of the first things that we've seen, even with the social justice issues that they ran into. I think civic engagement is just one of those ones where it does depend on the company itself to make sure that they are incorporating this into the national fold. And I think that Facebook does recognize the power. Obviously, social networks do recognize the power of influence. But I mentioned this on New Mexico in Focus, another show among the PBS family. I mentioned about how the importance of journalism, people like you, Khalil, and people like Marissa, are the reason why we're all civically engaged, because you tell the news. But there is an additional responsibility that the two of you took, almost like an untold oath without putting your hand on the Bible. And that's the responsibility of making sure that you report the right news, the facts. That's what all of us that have gone through journalism school have taken. And it is absolutely the responsibility of not only the media companies. It is good civic engagement that they do encourage it, but it's even more important to find factual reporters that have the principles of journalism in mind and understand the true freedom of the press, so that way they don't abuse it. And like I said on New Mexico in Focus, the journalist is as important as the media outlet, period.
It does come down, thank you for that. It comes down to us journalists being the fourth estate. And we've seen for quite some time, it wasn't just the past administration, but for quite some time, people kind of losing faith in journalism, or just picking out the type of journalism that fits into my particular pocket. Dr. Chavez was talking about our cognitive minds and our emotional minds. And it's like, I'm going to pick out the news source that follows my belief without challenging everything, everything from Fox News to now OAN, or we can see the rise of The Daily Show being a major source of news for people. What we try to do, at least with the show, Marissa, myself, and Taylor, we just try to find stories that relate to people that tell the truth. But I want to ask a question about data rights protections. I know this necessarily wasn't in the document, but it's something that fascinated us in the journalism and the work that we uncovered. You know, our data is being collected by social media sites, other sites, constantly. And many argue Cambridge Analytica, if you all are familiar, it's where Facebook was granted access to this now defunct company to gather private data on hundreds of millions of users. And that data was turned into psychological weaponry, particularly during the 2016 election. This wouldn't have happened if we had data rights. The EU has created data rights protections for their members, but we don't have it here. With more of our lives being lived online, do you all think it's time that lawmakers really took steps to protect data privacy of the people who live in the United States? Gus is a thumbs up. Darshan Gu.
So one of the recommendations in the report is around data. And it is the idea that, you know, we have a lot of hypotheses about how data is being used, how data can be used, how what is happening online is impacting the way people behave politically within their communities. The truth is we don't actually know a lot through sort of rigorous academic research, because scholars just don't have access to the data that the platforms have. And so one of the recommendations in the report is that there really does need to be legislation and regulation that require platform companies to create some guidelines around interoperability, data portability, data openness, so that researchers and scholars can start to really understand how these platforms are actually impacting political behavior and civic behavior, particularly, you know, around democratic engagement in digital contexts.
Dr. Gerald Chavez.
I mean, you're kind of walking into a bit of a den of snakes with that whole thing. I see the need of, when I did my dissertation, I explored the effects of death metal music on male adolescent aggression. The reason I did that was anytime a kid would shoot up a school, people would just start reporting stuff. I think some major newspapers said, oh, they were listening to Marilyn Manson. So then they condemned Marilyn Manson. So all this stuff mishmash sort of comes up, and then X amount of the population believes it, and that becomes kind of intractable because they heard Tucker Carlson say it, or whoever they heard say it, and all of a sudden it becomes this part of the narrative in the world, and to undo that is really hard. So, I mean, from a psychological standpoint, it becomes quite a slippery slope from free speech to everything else. So, I mean, that's a tough call, a real tough one for me anyway.
The doctor's right. I mean, I'm going to put my marketer hat on. You know, I went to school for journalism. And then all of a sudden, I found out that data can actually make my job better. And data can actually help me produce results. that's what's really challenging for us as marketers, is that we do have a responsibility to be wise and to be smart about the data that we have access to. It's the bad marketers that give us a bad name, those that are the ones that use it for, you know, trying to overthrow a nation. I'm very sensitive and a little bit emotional on this subject because the metaphor that I use about how important data is and how much it can mess with and it's interesting to have a psychologist on this panel, like, gambling addiction is a big thing, and gambling addiction is added and is fueled, and the catalyst for gambling addiction is actually data, the impact of a player card and being able to collect to watch and see how often they are spending money, where exactly they're going to, how often are they visiting, etc. So yes, there is absolutely a responsibility to make sure that you're not using the data in a malicious manner, but casinos still use that data to bring that person back. Everybody is willingly knowing that they're ruining the gambling addict's life and being an enabler. So from a political perspective, data can be very dangerous, but it also can produce results. And I don't ever encourage using data in an irresponsible way.
Part 4, motivation. Lastly, we dive into how citizens are inspired to learn about and become actively involved in our democracy.
Our common purpose calls for a year of service. They use an example. They throw it out there. $10,000 is put into a tax advantage savings plan for the government when you're born. When you come of age, you have a choice to participate in a year of service to the country. It doesn't have to be the military or AmeriCorps. Once that year is completed, you get the money. If you choose not to, that money goes back into the pool. What do you think of this plan? If this plan were something that were out now, seeing that in a few months, you're going to be graduated from college, is that something you would consider?
I think I would. Like we said, we're trying to educate people to get more involved in civics and civic life. This is a perfect way. I think the document brought up a parent who was like, I dropped off my kids who were first-time voters and they were scared to death. No one should be scared to death to vote for their president, their governor, who's going to impact their lives. So I think this year of service in whatever form it might be, you know, some people might not want to go the military route, but having that service and building your education and your knowledge around this is going to be beneficial at the end of the day. It's going to make people more confident. And when people are more confident, they're going to want to go out and vote. And voting is a practice. You know, you have to say, well, last time I didn't do the voting I should have done. I've learned more and I want to learn more. So it's a learning process for sure.
Darshan.
Plus one to everything she said. But also, you know, this idea that by encouraging more people to vote, requiring civic duty voting, as we talked about earlier in our conversation, that folks who aren't educated and don't know as much about what's happening would be making decisions. There's a lot of research that shows that the more people vote, the more it becomes a habit. And the more it becomes a habit, the more people learn. So folks may be voting for the first time and not knowing as much, but once they get into the habit of it, all of the things that go along with voting, becoming informed, learning, you know, taking away sort of the mystery of the process. There's a lot of research that shows that those things all sort of, you know, improve over time.
Totally fair point.
Oriana.
Khalil, you know, I would also add that civic engagement is a 24/7 endeavor. So I think our system really operates on a 2 and 4 year cycle. So there's like this push of attention and enormous amount of resources to engage voters or engage community like the month before an election. And that is not how you build a civic society. The groups, the trusted messengers, the community leaders are the best ones who are in a position to really do the civic engagement, the civic education, and they're the ones that are chronically underfunded. Election day is just the beginning, right? Like now the hard work starts to hold our elected officials accountable and work in partnership with them to make into reality a better future, a better community for all of us.
A lot of people want to be engaged with our democracy, with our country, but they feel they can't because the country is not really telling the truth about itself. Revisionist history is being promulgated and passed off as fact. Alternative history of our country leads to this division that we're all feeling now. You know, our refusal collectively to look truthfully at our past prevents us from really making things right. It stops us from moving forward. So in your minds, and I'm going to ask each of you, what can we do to admit our mistakes and move forward to inspire so many people who feel like the country doesn't stand for them or care about them, want to become involved and engaged in our civic process? Crystal.
apologize and mobilize. I think that's the two words that come to my head. You know, we're not a perfect society. We've learned from each other's mistakes. But I think it's important to make sure that you make amends. I think one of the things that my father, a Reagan Republican, has taught me, it's the act of forgiveness. So as long as the people are willing to forgive, and even though they might not forget, mobilize them and get them going and put them in a direction where they know that they can make that difference. And most importantly, be heard. It takes two to tango, and it takes two people to listen and also share ideas.
Dr. Chavez?
With the fact that there are some realistic, tangible things occurring with people, for example, not enough food on the table. They were earning X amount of money. Now they're not earning out as much money because they were a wait person or they were a musician or something. That sort of needs to be addressed. I'm not saying it's not being addressed. Some people are trying really hard to do that. You're still seeing the people on each intersection asking for money. They are still hurting. So as I think our politicians, they need to come out of their cryogenics chambers more often and live in the real world and be there and engage. And then the fact that our history hasn't been told, whether you're African-American or Native American or Chicano, whatever, those have not been told. Those stories have not been told. So there's a lot of things that have to be revealed and opened up, I think, for people to start to believe and to end this distorted thinking that people tend to spread, because it's only maintaining the status quo when the status quo is not working. And that's pretty darn obvious. But this report is an incredible beginning. This group of people, incredible beginning. But to go from here to the person who says, oh, that's really cute, but I got to go work my three jobs today. So I think it's a pretty deep, heavy problem. It has to be broader, I think, and everybody needs to engage, kind of like all of you are.
Gus.
Yeah, this is a really big question. And I know I'm not the person with the answer, but for me, what kind of resonates hearing that, it's not enough to acknowledge. We don't understand in our history whitewashes so much of the realities of the oppression that this country has caused for so many people and also still does internationally today. And we aren't at a point where we're willing to reckon with the atrocities we're committing daily, let alone offer any path for healing for the past. I mean, that's like a really complicated and hard process. And I think it needs to be more than saying sorry and asking people to assimilate into an oligarchy. I think it's on the burden of especially people who have had power in this country to not understand the plight of communities that they've oppressed, but to understand the violence of their privilege. And so that for me as a white man is about me understanding the violence of the patriarchy and understanding how I benefit from it and contribute to it, and also understanding that violence as a white person. And from there, I think, and if we choose to not let ourselves be coaxed into assimilating into a comfortable norm that doesn't serve everyone, that's when we open up a new solution space where we let people define the theories that allow our government to be a better, hopefully one day a democracy. And that theory has to come from people that are willing to proclaim where they feel civically empowered and how that's a civic empowerment that can be shared and it's not isolated. If it's isolated, it just means you're one rung higher on the ladder. And it only just means you're moving up instead of actually pulling the community in. And so I'm really interested in understanding ways that maybe we can, in our apologies, learn how to move information and power away from the system as it is and actually make one that's more functional temporally for all communities involved.
Oriana.
I think truth and reconciliation are definitely at the heart of it. You know, so just it's a painful process. And I think our democracy, our system of government and society is seeing that play out right now. The transformation, the pain of trying to make a multicultural democracy a reality. It's painful. Yeah, it's a process. And I think we definitely have to empower communities that have been left out of the process to have a seat at the table to re-envision this society. I come from a public policy background and law. I've studied social justice lawyering, and a really uncomfortable reality is that law is to uphold stare decisis, right? To uphold the way things are. And so to the doctor's point, the system is working the way it was designed to work. So it's actually working quite well. And so what I really appreciate about this report is that I found some of the recommendations to be very innovative and also just thinking about, like, what does a new system look like? And I think that's exactly the type of conversation we need to be having, not necessarily putting band-aids on the system we have. Let's make it better, but also, like, what does a US democracy in the 21st century really mean? If we allow ourselves to be innovative and bold, we could come up with something really transformational.
Taylor.
Yeah, so I just want to echo everything that everyone had said about education, because I think educating kids in high school about civics is going to empower them to actually go out in the world and vote and go into college and feel comfortable with talking about the broad society and broad United States history, because in high school and college, sometimes you only get a one perspective history of what makes us look good. And sometimes we do need to learn the darker parts of our history to engage how we're living our lives and how we're going out and saying, well, this community has always been disenfranchised, and the way we're acting and the way we choose to further our democracy is harming people still to this day. I mean, we do have all these resources available to us, and we just need to make sure we're using them to their best ability. It took us to go through a pandemic to realize people don't have internet access. They don't have access to technology, and that's not something we should be talking about in the 21st century.
Barry.
So I guess I get to be the counterpoint here. I think that revisionist history is a two-way street. I would point to the report itself when it talks about how young people are so willing to embrace authoritarianism as an alternative to representative democracy. I would also point to young other polling data that talks about everybody being all excited about younger people about socialism. I've been to socialist countries. I've had friends killed by socialist activists in those countries. Socialism is a dark, nasty, evil history, and nobody under 40 seems to have any notion of that. They think they're going to get Sweden, they're going to get Venezuela. Now we just leave it with that.
And Darshan.
I don't think I can say it any better than all of you have said it, but I did just want to point out one thing that I was so excited. You know, you work on these reports and you hope that the pieces of them resonate with everybody. And one of the things I've heard each of you say in different ways throughout our conversation is that you can't just look at this recommendation. It's really all of these things that matter and that make a difference, and that, you know, the order of things matters, and you, this wouldn't work if this didn't come first. And I'm so grateful to that, because one of the things this commission did that was a little bit different than other groups like this have done before is really try to step back and look at the big picture and not just talk about, say, you know, what needs to happen for voters or what needs to happen for how our elected officials interact with constituents or what's happening with social media, but to really look at the big picture and understand that there are pieces broken in our political institutions and our civil society and our political culture, and they are creating a vicious cycle and feeding on each other. Unless we really stand back and think about how all three of those spheres, what's happening in them, what's broken, what needs to be fixed, and start to get those three areas of American life, you know, our political institutions, our civil society, and our political culture working again, will continue to have that vicious cycle. And we really need to fix them so we can move into a virtuous cycle and they can, you know, build on each other in that way.
I want to thank everybody for joining us. I want to thank Dr. Gerald Chavez, Gus Petrotti, Christel Ciarza, Barry Bitzer, Oriana Sandoval, Taylor Velasquez, and Darshan Gu. Thank you all so much.
Your New Mexico Government, a collaboration between KUNM, New Mexico PBS, and the Santa Fe Reporter, is on top of all that's happening at the Roundhouse as the 55th state legislative session is in full swing. We don't have any updates on the show this week, but check out my conversation with Matt Grubbs about the battle to set the rules for the legislative session on KUNM's news broadcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. If you haven't followed us yet, do it. This YNMG segment will pop up in your feed. Money, money, money. That has been on most people's minds before the pandemic started. Cash is weighing on us even heavier as we try to pull ourselves out from under the pandemic waves. Next week, we take a look at what's going on in the economy and what's the deal with Wall Street, Reddit, and GameStop. Tune in next week on No More Normal. We want to thank each of our panelists for the insightful conversation and for them offering their experience and expertise to the discussion. To join in, hit up our social media. As on Instagram, we're conducting polls on some of the recommendations in our common purpose. Find us at nomono.podcast to offer your opinion and vote. If you want to read the whole document we're talking about today, we'll have a link to it on the post for this show online at KUNM.org. Many thanks to Jazztone, the producer, Cheo, Dom Life, and Olaud Records for providing music to the show. Khaki, Pope Yes Yes Y'all, and Bigawatt produced some of the show's themes. No More Normal is executive produced by Marisa DeMarco. It's hosted and produced by yours truly. Taylor Velasquez handles all the social media and helps out with the editing. Remember that our democracy depends on our involvement to ensure that it works for us all. That's what it's supposed to do. Work for you. I'm Khalil Ekolona. For everyone here at No More Normal, thanks for listening.